Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, March 25th, 2024. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the two words that say start here in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description and explanation, a primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 19 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you choose to do that, before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And we hope people do all of that soon and often, primarily because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives the more they actively apply these tools in their lives. And secondarily, because it tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, we would appreciate you doing so by giving us a call at 563-999-3581. When you call that number, if you press 1 on your phone, it will put the little icon of a hand by your phone number. I will see it, turn on the microphone, and announce you by your area code so that you and I can have a conversation. And if you'd like to get some comments, feedback, question, testimonial, assistance in any way, you can email us. If you do not want to call, you can email Jeannie at J-E-A-N-I-E at whyagain.org. That's W-H-Y-A-G-A-I-N.org. Or you can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. And when we get those from you, we will address the comment, question, feedback on the internet show. And then as time allows, send you a notification about what day and time that occurred so that you can listen back to the archives for your feedback or input. And we always appreciate whenever anybody does that, because it just makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. And the intention we have with this work is to be a service. And that's just infinitely easier to do when we know how things are landing for you. So today is a Monday, and we have plenty of time for comments, questions, answers, testimonials. I've been working through the book by Christine Blasey Ford, and the title of the book is One Way Back. And the more I listen to that book and the more I watch the news and see what's going on, the more I realize how really out of whack many of us get in this culture and that our culture itself is. And one of the ways that things get so out of whack is that people take a very myopic view. It's me first, me second, and me third kind of a view. It's me, me, me. And it's me, me, me in a way of, you know, what do I want and what can I get, as opposed to what can I do to help? You know, some of the Native American writings and anthologies talk about personal rights in the Western culture, and from the Native American or indigenous cultures, it's a personal responsibility. I have a responsibility to my family, to my culture, to the environment, etc. And so while it is useful at certain ways to just focus on yourself, because that's many times all you have control over, if you're doing that focus on yourself from a selfish perspective, then you're just doing what your culture has trained you into, and then you're adding to the complexity of the problem rather than becoming part of the solution. So I'm just encouraging people day in and day out to, yes, please do stay focused on yourself, because that's oftentimes in any given situation the only thing you truly have any control over. And then I'm also encouraging people to be living in the observation so that you can observe, how is what I'm choosing impacting myself and the people around me? And if I think in terms of my responsibility to my family and my culture, and I watch for the, you know, observations of what's the impact of my choices, I can be living in that observation to better effect, because then I can be making adjustments on the go to make sure that I'm contributing to resolution of situations and difficulties rather than perpetuation of them. And that's my offering as we start today. The idea of, there are so many of us who are completely immersed in the training of our culture, our family, the conditioning, if you will, and we're not questioning any of it. We think we know, and we think we're right, and we have this great certainty about ourselves, and yet we still have tightness or tension. We still have frustration or sadness or fear. And what we're trying to encourage people to observe in this work is that the very best use of any of those emotions, tightness, tension in my body, et cetera, any discomfort, the very best use of it that we have discerned is to make it be an alarm system that wakes me up to the idea that something about my process in this moment is off the mark. And this is, you know, quite literally the opposite of what our culture trains us into. Our culture will train us into the idea that when we have any tightness or tension or fear or anger or negative emotional state, that must mean someone or something outside of us is off the mark, and they should be either attacked or run away from or bribed or seduced to try to get them to change so that I don't have to feel this tightness or tension or negative emotional state. And in this work, we're advocating for the opposite of that. We're advocating for the recognition that each of us is busy, whether we realize it or not, creating our own emotional response. Any emotion that we experience is a self-created phenomenon. And if we want something different, we have to change what we're doing with our mind energy, with the creative force we've been given, which we call thought or mind energy. And so aside from just having an experience, I can wake up to the fact that I'm a creator of my experience. And I can step into the use of tools to quickly, if not immediately, modify that experience. And some of us have an easier time doing that than others. Some of us have been raised by people that modeled doing that. And so it works easier and better for some of us if it's all been a part of our training and conditioning most of our lives. And others of us have all kinds of trauma that we need to either work through or release the energies from or of, and that's where the use of these tools becomes so valuable. So if I haven't had it role modeled for me, I may have to be the pioneer in my family or in my friends group. And so I'm not working off of muscle memory of having learned this from my family of origin or my culture, and yet I can learn it, and I can, you know, take advantage of things like the tools that are offered through various places and on this particular website through what Michael and Jeannie offer. And I can use them to great advantage to start making myself able to structure an entirely different reality soon and often. So our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. On this Monday, what's moving for you? What would be of most interest for you, the way to spend this first hour of the 2 hours we have available to us? One of the themes of the people that I interacted with over this past weekend was the idea of the way we interpret things as either being a blessing or a curse. And if I have a negative filter active, it doesn't even really matter how many other people might be thrilled to have my circumstances. I'm going to find something to complain about. And then because I'm complaining about it, my experience of it gets even worse. And so I'm blessed to have been raised by people who chose more often than not for optimism. And I've had, you know, some would say very blessed life circumstances. And yet, it's not like this is happening without disruption. You know, and I could look at different things in my life and say, wow, you're certainly lucky. You're very blessed. And I can look at other things in my life and say, wow, it's really rough that that had to happen and that that was something that occurred, you know, without you having any control whatsoever. And so then people would then say, oh, so that's tragic that that happened to you. And I could, you know, adopt that interpretation that that was tragic, or I could just say, well, that's intense and I need to deal with it, and I'm really fortunate that I have these resources for dealing with it. Either way, the point of this little monologue is the way I choose to interpret and respond to the events in my life is far more important than the actual events of my life. And it has ever been thus in my life, and I see examples of it over and over and over again, and I suffer the longer, and I slumber in my suffering the longer I believe I don't have any choice in this matter. This is a horrible thing and it never should have happened and I'm an innocent victim. As I do that, I suffer. I create an experience of suffering when, you know, in truth, the only thing that really happened was life is unfolding and it might require an adjustment and it might be somewhat uncomfortable, but suffering is not necessary. Being in the moment, being willing to go with the flow, being willing to question what's mine to do here to be a blessing to myself and others, being willing to engage in the use of tools, all of these things eliminate the suffering. Area code 541, you're in the air.
Good morning, Dr. Tim. This is Celinda.
Good morning.
Thank you for that monologue. I'm building ears, just like I mentioned the other day. I thought of a person that you might like to interview because she's been in the educational system most of her life. She's also a researcher and a college professor, or was if she's not retired. Her name is Carla Hannaford. I don't know if you've ever heard of her or not. But she has two books here that are called The Smart Moves, Why Learning is Not All in Your Head, and The Dominance Factor, How Knowing Your Dominant Eye, Ear, Brain, Hand, and Foot Can Improve Your Learning, which has 32 different learning profiles in it that has been very, very helpful for me. I first learned about her from Touch Your Health and from educational kinesiology. So I thought I'd share that with you because she's still working and expanding her awareness. And I just thought, and has websites, I just thought you might like to look at that and see if it's something that would fit with Mind Shifters. I would love to introduce her to the Aramaic Gospel, too, because I see it as dovetailing beautifully with her work.
All right.
You could
I just
introduce her in a much better fashion than I can, I'm sure, other than I'm a contact point is all. She would probably remember me from classes. She did. And her name is Carla with a C and Hannah Ford, Hannaford. You might check her out and see what you think.
Yep, I just found I'm not sure if it's her website, but Simple Families is a website that has a picture of her.
She's kind of blonde.
Yeah.
Oh, well, it might be her. She's out of Kalispell, Montana, if that's helpful.
All right. I'll check into it.
Thank you, sir. And I'll listen. I like your monologues. Thank you.
All right. I'll mute you so you can listen in. And we'll invite somebody else to raise a hand and either make a recommendation of someone we should interview and or comment about what would be most useful for you as we march on to the end of March, so to speak. We're here on March 25th, and we have one of the things we've been doing, among other conversations we've had sprinkled with other people and worksheets, et cetera, is we've been working through Lesson 15 in the Way of Mastery. And the last time we talked about this, we were reading in that book where Lesson 15 is titled, The Only Energy That Can Separate You from the Kingdom. In case it isn't clear, the kingdom is a state of mind. It is an ability to be fully alertly connected with the truth of your nature and the awareness of your connection to all of creation. It's this instant, constant, in-the-moment awareness of the capital T truth. And it's called many things. It's been called heaven. It's been called the kingdom. It's been called the Christ mind. It's been called the one mind. And in Lesson 15, the message is very, very clear. You don't have to do anything to get there, to go there, to earn it. It is the truth of your nature. It is your inheritance. It is the birthright, whatever you want to call it. And the only thing that can block you from it is an energy. And the energy is self-created. The energy is the false belief in something other than the truth of life. So if you use your mind energy to believe that you are or can be or could be or will be separated from that which created you, that's the only thing that gives you the dream of separation, the lived experience of not being one with your Creator. The only energy that can separate you from this state of mind in which you have this immediate, constant awareness that you are one with that which created you, and just to begin reading from that section again, I realize it's a repeat of what we did the last time I was reading here, but the text reads in this section in Lesson 15, "Beloved friends, the world that you look upon is not real. It has never been real. It will never be real." And so, just like in the work in A Course in Miracles, there are a number of different places where it says the world is not real. And then people run around thinking that the Course in Miracles is telling you that there's nothing here and that you don't exist, and so it doesn't really matter what you do in the world. And for clarification on that, you might want to take advantage of Dr. Michael Rice's YouTube channel. And if you go there and you click on his YouTube channel, and then you search for What is the World? He has a video where he does a very good job of outlining an entirely different way to understand what the Course in Miracles and Way of Mastery are saying when they say the world that you look upon is not real. They're not saying there is nothing here. They're not saying the world isn't real. But they're saying that your perception is a best guess, is a very rough guess about the true nature of life, and that your senses do not allow you to see the interconnectedness of all things. Your senses do not allow you to read subtle energies. Your senses show you only a tiny fraction of what is actually going on at any given moment. And beyond that, your conscious awareness is only able to track a tiny fraction of what your senses register. So when it says the world that you look upon is not real, they're talking about how your perception is not the truth of what is in the world, that your perception is your best guess, and yet it is woefully lacking, and that there are other ways to other, you know, user interfaces, we might say, than just your five senses. And that's what we began with in the first lesson of the Way of Mastery. It says, look, this is all about the way of the heart. Another way to talk about the way of the heart is it's a different user interface between you and the world around you, other than your conscious logical mind or your intellect. And you're invited in this work to explore, to play around with, to stretch yourself, to have life experiences that are not driven exclusively by your intellect. So just to be clear, so we don't run down any rabbit holes of thinking, oh, so the world doesn't exist and it doesn't matter what I do, that's not what's being said here. What's being said here is when you perceive something that's less than love, it's not the truth. It's a distortion. And what you are perceiving is a creation. And as the text goes on here, it says, that creation can be impregnated with the perfect love of the Creator. And remember always that there is either only love or fear, meaning there's either only love or the pulling away from love, or an illusion about being able to separate from love. There's either wide awake, full experience of life in all of its glory, or there's contraction. There's either being wide open and breathing and allowing the energy of life to move through you and embracing it as a beyond words phenomenally beautiful experience, or there's contracting away from it. There's being the tightness and the tension which constricts you as a conduit for that loving creative energy. So this text in that first paragraph says, beloved friends, the world that you look upon is not real. It has never been real, and it never will be real. It is a creation, though, that can be impregnated with the perfect love of the Creator, with the focus on its true nature as creation extending and expressing. And then it says, remember always that there is only love or fear, what is not love can only be fear, and that is never justified. The world that you've made, the world that you perceive with your senses, is thoroughly harmless. It can't ever ruin your true nature. It can't ever hurt you in any true sense. Now, certainly, you can have physical harm, pain, and discomfort. You can, the body can end, etc., but that's not what this teaching is about. This teaching is about how your true nature is not the body. Your true nature is not your thoughts about yourself or your thoughts about your body. The world you experience, which is the world you have made in conjunction with others in any given moment, offers to you the opportunity to choose to impregnate it with capital L love, or, I mean, that's the only two options here are. You impregnate it with love, you bless it, you welcome it, you revel in it, or you allow it to reflect to you your fearful thoughts. But this is your allowing it to reflect your fearful thoughts. This is you projecting fearful thoughts onto it. It's like what I talk about with people when I say, do you realize that there's no such thing as a natural disaster? And they, you know, when I first present this to people, that they just, there's all kinds of vehement response to the negative about this. But the fact of the matter is there's no such thing as a natural disaster. There's just nature. And then we label it as wonderful or disastrous. The impacts of a tornado are just the impacts of a tornado until a human mind comes along and says that's bad. That's tragic. That's horrible. So there's judgment from the human mind that's laid on top of the flow of life. So in this paragraph, it's saying the world you make with your thoughts and in conjunction with all of the others in your culture and your family is completely harmless. And it's there with the possibility that you either impregnate it with love and you bless it and you revel in the glory of your being able to be there to witness it and be conscious of it, or you let it reflect to you your fearful thoughts. And it's important from this teaching that we recognize that we are not limited at any time. In you, all the power under heaven and earth is given. You get to choose the focus of your conscious awareness in each new present moment, and that is the actual dynamic that creates your experience of life. You have a phrase in your world that says, there is nothing to fear but fear itself. And that is 98% accurate. Fear is the only energy that can separate you from the kingdom. And fear is never justified at any moment. Now, the last 2% would be to say that there's nothing to fear, since fear is only temporary insanity. And your right-mindedness is but a choice away. Therefore, begin to look upon each situation, each moment, or each minute of life as a very separate scene in a movie. It has its certain set of characters. It has a beginning. It has an end. Although you are eternal, the things of time are not eternal. And the things that are birthed in time will end in time. Therefore, you will use the moment birthed in time, and you'll have a choice about how to use it. Will you use it to bless all of creation? Will you use it to impregnate it with love, as it says in this previous paragraph? Or will you use it to project your fearful thoughts upon it and let it reflect them back to you? or will you use it to help you bring what is eternal to your conscious awareness in the moment? Or will you continue to believe that yet within you, there is no possibility to choose love over fear? This is our call. This is our invitation with this work, to recognize what we're doing with our mind energy. I have had several people over this weekend called into my awareness, as I mentioned a little bit before I started reading this book, and they have life circumstances that probably 80 or 90% of the human beings on this planet would love to have. And they're choosing a filter of negativity. They're choosing to be miserable, and they're choosing to focus on certain things in their life that aren't what they want them to be. But in that moment of choosing to focus on what they don't want, they're ignoring the nice roof over their head, the climate control, you know, the warmth of the heater and the furnace in the winter and the cool in the summer, and the fact that they've got enough money to pay their bills, and the fact that they have relative health, and the fact that they're living in a country that's not war-torn at the moment, and to hear these people talk, you would think they're in the middle of the Gaza Strip starving to death and being bombed, because they're so upset about what they don't have that they want. And that's what this lesson is pointing us to. It's the invitation to wake up to, what are you doing with your mind energy? Because whatever we focus our mind energy on is going to be the thing that creates our experience of life. So the text goes on here and says, look around you. What do your eyes show you? Would you bless it or curse it? What would you teach yourself and therefore make it true for you? The message of this lesson is being given slowly, deliberately, and carefully. For we want you to make no mistake. Really slow down. Try and grasp what's being shared, both in terms of the practice and in the theory. Now, theory is important in your world, for it's only through theory that the mind, the little part of you that is arrogant, will finally decide whether to value what this theory offers. And when you've placed value upon what the theory offers to you, then you're willing to embark on the practices that it requires. It's like, I think I talked about somebody the other day who was introduced to some, I don't know whether it was Ho'oponopono or the Four Agreements, and this person said, why should I do that? And unless someone can give them a reason or a series of reasons about why it might be of value to play with or practice using Ho'oponopono or the Four Agreements as a model for a template for their approach to the world, unless someone can give them a theory about how it might be useful, they won't even engage it. They'll just run away from it, or they'll block it out, or say that's just woo-woo stuff, or it has no relevance to me. So the text here goes on and says, therefore, in this lesson, we're choosing to speak with you more rationally than emotionally. We would ask you to consider this. Have you suffered enough? Have you kept yourself small long enough? Have you tasted limitation deeply enough to know that you want these things no longer? If that's the case, would you be willing to patiently choose the dissolving of your illusions? Because just on the other side of each illusion is the freedom and peace that you seek. In any moment, you can tell quite clearly what you're most committed to. If the body is tight and uncomfortable, if you feel you must speak in a louder voice, if your words come more quickly, if the brow is furrowed and the jaw is tense, then rest assured you have chosen to be devoted to fear in that moment. Fear is what you're committed to. You are like one who carries a magic wand filled with such power that you could merely wave it upon the face of the earth and extend the kingdom of heaven to every heart and every mind. What then can prevent the expression of such power? The only thing that can prevent the expression of such power is the fear you have made to replace the capital R reality of capital L love. As you look upon each segment, each scene, and each minute in your movie, begin to cultivate the deliberate practice of recognizing that you are in a field of energy that is your perfect servant. Within that moment, you are the one with the power to make that moment be whatever you wish it to be. It can be filled with Christ consciousness, or it can be filled with temporary insanity. The choice is always yours, and never, ever has there been such a thing as a victim. And let's be very clear about this. What they're saying in that phrase, in that statement, is that you always have the choice about how you're going to interpret and respond to the life events that express in, through, as, and around you. You don't always have the immediate choice of those life events. This book is not saying that everybody in the Gaza Strip chose to have violence done to others and done to themselves and their food supply disrupted. This work is saying everyone in that situation has the ability to choose how they will interpret and respond to it. Not everybody that was in that situation ended up attacking somebody and trying to steal their food. Some people who were hungry were loving and gentle with others, and some people that found themselves hungry decided they were going to stampede and try and, steal food from others and be violent against somebody that they thought had food that they wanted. Every one of us has a choice to make all the time. How are we going to choose to interpret and respond to whatever is unfolding around us in our lives? That's the point of this particular part of this lesson, when it says, never has anybody been a victim in this sense, that your ability to choose how you're going to interpret and respond to life events remains with you. That can't ever be taken from you. Clearly not saying you're the one who chose to have a tornado come through your town and wipe out your neighborhood or your best friend's house. It is saying that when that happens, the choice is always yours about whether you will stay wide open and allow the flow of life and bless it and impregnate it with the mind of Christ and the love of the Creator, or will you contract and recoil and tighten and tense and generate fear and negative emotions and project that out into life events and then let life events reflect back to you your fearful thoughts. So the text goes on and it says, therefore, as you enter into any one of your moments, ask yourself this. What is this moment for? What do I decree this moment to be? And what do I most want to learn by teaching it, by living it, by giving it away to others in this moment? Now, if you would, for just a minute, take a breath and just think, how will your life be different if you remember, even once every 10 minutes, to think about this next moment? Even if you did this just once every 10 or 15 minutes and thought, okay, what is this moment for? What do I decree this moment to be? What do I most want? And then how do I give that away? Because whatever I want, I need to give it away first, and it will be coming back to me. The text goes on and reads, to teach is to demonstrate. To demonstrate is to express what you have decided will hold the greatest value for you. Remember, just a few paragraphs earlier, it says, in any moment you can tell clearly what you're most committed to just by noticing how you're feeling and what you're choosing to focus on. Here it says, to demonstrate is to teach, and to teach and to demonstrate means to express what you've decided will hold the greatest value for you. Whenever you judge another, you're decreeing that the thing of greatest value is separation and judgment and contraction, because judgment always causes contraction, and therefore separation, or the dream of separation, the lived experience of separation from another person. When in the truth, capital T, truth of life, we're all connected. And then it goes on and says, when you practice forgiveness, you are decreeing that what you value is joining in holy, peace-filled relationship, consciously stepping into the awareness of your true nature and your connection to everyone and everything. It says, remember that forgiveness has nothing at all to do with saying to another person, I can see that you've sinned, but I forgive you of your faults. No, that's got nothing to do with forgiveness. Forgiveness is the absolute recognition that nothing has been done to you, and that in that moment, when something has unfolded, you would prefer to see the face of Christ in the person in front of you. You would prefer to impregnate that moment of life with the energy of the Creator, the energy of love, the energy of allowance and surrender and trusting and embracing. Forgiveness is about dismantling your judgments, dismantling perception, asking to be shown the truth of life, asking to be shown how to be a blessing to yourself and others. The text goes on and says, Easter celebrates resurrection. It has been made to celebrate my resurrection. But this has only served to turn your attention from the specialness in the sense of your own uniqueness to the specialness of your existence and your reality that you've placed your attention on me and mine, as though Christ was something merely historical, as if I'm special in the eyes of our Creator. And that's not accurate, according to this teaching. No other person has ever had more value than you have in this present moment. We are all sparks of the one mind. We are all connected. And the focus, as I was mentioning in the monologue, on self, and being self-wise about it, focusing on what I have control over within my own mind energy and the choice of my focus of my mind energy is highly preferable to focusing on myself and trying to acquire stuff specifically for me without any consideration about what impact that's having on the people around me or my life itself. So in this lesson, it's asking us to wake up to our own reconnection. You could call it resurrection. Our own reestablishment of the awareness of our true nature and the gift of awareness that is the life we've been given. And in doing that, I'm not looking outside of myself to someone else or something else. Yes, even including a God or a Jesus or any kind of deity outside of me, because the core of this teaching is echoed in the words that have been attributed to Yeshua, saying that the kingdom is within. What kingdom is that? It's the kingdom of heaven. It's the kingdom of the awareness of the connectedness of all beings and all things. It's a reverence for the flow of life itself. So we've got about 6 or 7 minutes for comments or questions. 563-999-3581. Call that number, press 1 on your phone, and we can have a conversation. How is this landing for you? How, if you're still here and you've been listening to us read Way of Mastery for a while, this isn't brand new to you, the concept that this thing they call the Christ is not a person, it's a state of mind. It's a level of awareness. It's an acceptance of the connectedness of all things, including your mind energy. How is that resonating for you as we sit here in the 15th lesson of the Way of Mastery? Is it stirring up old religious beliefs and resistance, as it does for many? Is it getting easier to consider that perhaps that is a truth? Does it still feel like a big pill to swallow? That there's no one or anything outside of you that's going to bring you salvation? Or is it just making sense at a new level? 563-999-3581. If you call that number, press 1 on your phone, we can have a conversation. The idea here is religions have kept the focus outside of the person. And this set of teachings is inviting us to have the focus inside, to bring us to awareness of our true nature and our connection to a source, which, as Guy Finley says, your Creator didn't put you in a world where if you sojourn to the Himalayas and search the caves and that you might find a guru that can give you some answers. He says your Creator put you in a world where your instant, constant connection to the forces that can teach you will never abandon you if you just ask to be taught. So can you ask? Will you ask? Does that make sense? You're in the air.
Hello, Dr. Tim. This was very good. I had a little inner battle because this week is considered Holy Week by many people in the Christian traditions. And at my parish, we have a noon mass every day. And I was talking to Tim Bingham about, you want to go? And he, you know, we were discussing, and I said, it's a toss-up between the radio show. Well, here I am on the radio show, so you know what I didn't go to. So the fact that you're bringing in this idea of the resurrection, and it's an inside job and nobody's a victim, and, of course, Jesus is considered a tremendous victim. He doesn't feel himself to be a victim, but we call him a victim. Anyway, it's just great to hear. I feel as if I've been recalibrated. you know, the events of the world, I let them get to me. I get triggered by them. I listen more than I should to the news. And it's just good to have this as a recalibration. And we're probably going to need it constantly for a while. But so it's thanks for your, not only the reading, but your comments.
You're quite welcome and deserving. So Linda has put her hand up again, so I just turned on her microphone.
Thank you for that, Susan. I picked up on that also. I wanted to make just one real quick comment, Dr. Tim, about the impregnation. I never thought about it in that way in relation to the Creator. By, you know, there's mention that the Creator is our Father, and impregnation is kind of assumed by some of us. But to think about impregnation, love, impregnating love in the situation, into the perception, into the thinking, the emotions, and the body response, is a very, very wonderful concept for me. I never looked at it that way. The other thing is, is it possible to say that with fear we are impregnating the collective consciousness with fear and hostility? Not actuality, but the collective consciousness?
Yeah, I guess you could. I think that what the reason they don't say it that way in the book is because fear is not a creative force.
Okay.
And the idea of impregnating something is to give it life, to bring life from it. And so we're encouraged to infuse or impregnate each moment with this awareness of our true nature and the energy of creation and love. And if we shy away from that, then we're choosing for fear. But that's not a creative act. So that's probably
okay.
Why they don't use, you know, that's probably why they don't use it in that way.
How could
it's
we
really
find
just,
a...
It's really just retracting away from, recoiling from the creation and the creative energy. And that's how we create the experience of fear. It's not a, that's why they say there is no such thing as fear. There's only love or fear. And of those two, only love is real. That fear is this false creation of an experience. It's not a creative force. So let that suffice for now.
What kind of languaging could we replace that with for fear? Because it definitely has an impact on the earth itself, that withdrawal.
It doesn't have an impact, right? It's saying that the earth itself that you're talking about isn't real because it's hitting your perception. It's retracting away from what's real. And so
okay.
It puts us in the experience of, oh, woe is me and the world that, you know, is in danger and all that good stuff. When this teaching says that's never been true. The only thing that's true is the love, the extension of the creative force. So thank you both for your comments and questions. I'll mute you so you can listen to the second hour Remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I just pulled in the driveway and ran up the stairs. Perfect timing. Thanks.
All right. Have a great show.
Thank you. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. And today is Monday, March the 25th, 2024. And their call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us, and we would love to hear your comments and questions, because that makes this your show. And Michael said he'd be just 1 minute getting dialed in, and so I'll just share, you know, I was working with someone the other day, and it's a great testimony. I'm going to have to ask him to write it up or call it in or something, but been doing private sessions with him and going over different things, and when we met the other day, he said that it was really wild that, you know, he had moved back closer to home to take care of his parents, and while he was away, he didn't see a lot of the family dynamic stuff going on, all the craziness, because he was not personally involved in it. He was further away. And now that he's right there in it, and he said, but, you know, he said, it's amazing because since I've been doing this work, he said, I am aware and I can see it and I can think, you know, oh, wow, you know, this is our family crazy, but not get involved in it, not get wrapped up in it. And, you know, he can stay connected to being and look at it and attempt to, you know, assist his mom and dad and sister to, you know, engage in the work to do their own healing. And so, but he said, you know, it was just awesome to be able, he said, you know, 6 months ago, he said, if all of this had happened and I'd been right here in the middle of it, he said, I'd have just been bouncing. And he said, but I can just sit back and look at it. And, you know, he was smiling. And I said, you know, it's awesome to see you smile as you're talking about it. And so, you know, the work works. He said that, you know, he was telling his sister, you know, that she really needed some help. She needed therapy or something. And she said, well, you know, I don't trust anybody to talk to him. And he said, well, I can give you a lady's name that you can trust her. And said she'll help you. So, you know, hopefully we'll see if he can get the rest of his family into doing the work, and that would be awesome. Not really made a whole lot of changes on the website. The next couple months are really busy, crazy. Going to keep us on our toes. So I went ahead and created shows out through the end of May just to try to stay ahead of it. But other than doing that, I don't believe I've made any changes. We do have a couple of questions that came in. So, when you're ready, I will read the questions that came in. I think you're with
us. Awesome, dear heart. Let's go for it.
Oh, okay. So one says, we've talked to her before. Her name's Maria. And she says, I'm at a loss for words at this moment. A high, a joy, because my story is long, full of pain, but I received the most beautiful gift. For good morning, a mother who loved me unconditionally. This is a gift that I have consciously cultivated within myself for 30 years, and I'm going to be 50 this year. Since adolescence, I was looking for philosophers. I wanted to seek religion, but the Catholic Church shouted that it was my fault. I had to run away from that because the pain in my heart and the dissonance were unbearable. I am a seeker of the magic of unconditional love. In the entire world around me. I never ask why, but rather, why did this happen to me? Today, I know most of the answers, but I admit that I am a seeker. Thank you for reminding me. Thank you for the lesson. But I am going back to the desert to be a diligent student. You more than now, the Aramaic forgiveness says subtly, I will have to be careful and gentle about this. I have to listen to the rustling sounds. So I'm not sure that there's really a question in that, but you might want to address her unconditional love that she's seeking.
Yes, for sure. And it sounds like it's someone who's really taken a hold of the work and putting it to work in her life. So that's pretty awesome. And as Jeannie mentions, the idea of unconditional love, and that's carbon-based memories game is that love is something I'm going to get from you, or I'm going to give to you, or I'm going to do to you, or you're going to do to me, rather than experiencing ourselves as the presence of love. Many times people ask me for a definition of love, and I can't, I mean, there aren't enough words in the English language for it, but there is an experiential definition, and that is just hold a newborn child. If you go back to the moment where you've held a newborn and you tap into the essence of that newborn, we've asked this question all over the globe between Jeannie and I of tens of thousands of people, and everybody's answer is always some variation on the theme of love. Why? Because we all know what human life is. And if you notice when you hold that newborn isn't loving you. It's not a verb. It's not something they're doing to you. Are. It's what you and I are. And our culture being trapped in the Greek orientation and the Greek mindset and the words of the culture, we live in a space where the culture specializes in knocking the experience of love out of us. And then, along about the age of 14, 16, 18 or so, they push us out the door and say, now, go find somebody to love, or go find somebody to love you. And my offering is, that's a whole false search. It's a whole false language. That language will lead to death. Now, the highest that the not what we'll call the non-being mind or the mind of man has to offer is that idea of, well, I noticed that I was conditional in my love for you, so now I'm going to go to unconditional. But really, what most people call love in the culture is just a venial form of approval, i.e., I approve of you as long as you're doing everything that I want you to do. And if you stop doing what I want you to do, then the honeymoon is over and love is gone. Well, love, once experienced, can't go. It can only be what it is. And when we give the mind a false set of goals by falsely defined words, then we're going to be lost in those words, and the goals formed by those words are unachievable, so it tends to lead to an extreme state of frustration for people. And so, and that's why so many people in relationships, they face this deep, deep frustration, like, why am I so frustrated? And of course, they're in denial, it's with my partner. Well, my offering is nobody's ever been frustrated with their partner. But there are lots of people who've had frustration in them that pin their frustration to their brain's image of their partner. And so my suggestion would be to give up this idea of ever trying to love anyone ever again, or of loving yourself, pin to the true definition of the word, and that is experience. Set your mind on track where it supports you experiencing yourself as the presence of love, and that you're able to hold that state of extending that love in an all-embracing fashion, so that if you were to come face-to-face with Hitler, you could extend love in his direction, because there's nothing in you based in pain around the extreme insanity that happened in that time and place. So when I'm in someone's space, if I can't hold to myself as the active presence of love, then I have work to do. There's something in my carbon-based memory system that is resonated in that situation by that person, by those events, that replace my experience of myself as love with some form of hostility or fear. And when I apply forgiveness to that hostility or fear that blocks myself as the awareness of being love, then circumstance in which yesterday I maybe went berserk, I just stand there and go, oh, okay, I see. I am the presence of love, whatever somebody else does or doesn't do, whatever happens in the world, whatever the travesty or the tragedy. If I can bring the state of being active present love, and I'm not talking, again, about the venial form of this culture's, you know, love is sexual athletics or what have you. I'm talking about bringing the true experience of yourself as the presence of love into your mind, into your body, into every circumstance in your life. That's the assignment. You know, when they tell us that Yeshua, when they asked him what's most important in the law, and the law, by the way, the word means the way it works. It doesn't mean the rule of a superior. What's most important in the way a human life works? He didn't say love your neighbor. He didn't say love God. He said have rachma for your neighbor. Have rachma for God. And he didn't say love God and neighbor as yourself, like the Greeks tell us. He said have rachma when you think of the Creator. Have rachma when you think of neighbor. And by so doing, you maintain your human life, which is love. So the directive was that there's a filter in the frontal lobes of the brain. And there's no such concept as this in the English language or the Greek or the Latin. It just doesn't exist. But what they understood in Aramaic is that there is a filter slash gateway in the frontal lobes of the brain that when active, filters out all intentions based in hostility and fear. Everything negative and destructive is filtered out. And only intentions keyed to love are available to the mind to use as raw material for its goals. And so that's the filter aspect of it. And then rachma is a gateway. It's literally the doorway into which human life, love, enters a human form. Just because someone has a human form does not mean there is anything that even resembles a human life. You look at people in their rage and their hatred and their vengeance, there's no human life active there. There is a human life behind the behaviors of that particular body-mind unit, but there's no human life active. What Yeshua gave was the key, and again, there's nothing in the language. We have to build the brain cells for, oh, okay, so there is a filter in the frontal lobes of my brain that if I learn to activate it, if I continuously, when I find myself in any form of hostility or fear, I continuously reset that presence of love, or pardon me, that filter, that gateway, then I get to experience the presence of love in me. Now, if someone is just filled with all kinds of rage and hatred and vengeance, that isn't going to last for more than a fraction of a second, and that other energy is going to come in and take over. And so when one enters into the practice of bringing rachma to activity in the mind, then in physiology, literally, the active presence of love shows up. And if in the condition or the situation where that hostility or fear is active, I then apply forgiveness to remove that which is stored in my carbon-based memory that is based in some form of hostility or fear. And as I remove that, as I forgive that particular energy, then I'm freed of its interference. And more as I move forward, I was talking to someone this morning, and they were talking about how there was a time when they were trapped in alcohol and, you know, crazy, crazy stuff going on, and that they recently had, they've been doing this work for some years, and they recently had an experience that in the past would have sent them back to the bottle and would have had them in crazy time. And instead, they were able to simply stand back and notice that, oh, this is where my mind used to do crazy time. And I've cleaned crazy time out of my mind. So am I perfect at this moment? No, I've got more work to do, but I can recognize myself as love and continue to move forward with the work of being the presence of active love. And then I'm able to extend that love in an all-embracing fashion so that I don't give up my human life for anything or anybody. Whatever somebody does, I maintain my human life. That's what Rachma empowers us to do. So I hope that fits and makes sense, and delighted that the tools have impacted you and that things are rocking and moving forward. That's awesome. I actually had gotten, or Jeannie, I think this was actually an email that you forwarded to me, and I just came across it this morning. Just one second here. Let me see if I can locate that. I'm not. I would have read it so that I made sure to get it correctly. But in any event, the basic message that this gentleman sent, he'd been doing this work for several years, and the work of another individual, and realized that he had, rather than having to spend a lifetime doing his work through what this other gentleman offered, he was actually suggesting we coordinate and do some work together because our work was similar, but as a result of the work he'd done with this other gentleman and what he'd learned with these tools, that he felt like he'd literally saved himself a lifetime. So that's pretty cool. Pretty nice experience to have, or acknowledgement to get that we're having that kind of impact, and I hope we're having that kind of impact for everybody. So, Machini, any other thoughts on that question for you? That either I or you could be offering?
And you may have mentioned this, and I apologize. I was multitasking here.
Okay.
That saying unconditional, that the focus is still on conditions.
Right. Rather than that, all-embracing.
Right.
And in most cases, that's kind of the highest that the non-being mind has to offer is unconditional.
Right. We do have another email.
Oh, great.
And she says, good morning, mind shifters. What is your take on the meaning, if accurately translated, of new heaven and earth in the scriptures where it says, for behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered or come to mind?
Well, I was just talking about that, actually, in a sense, with the experience that I shared from a woman I was talking to this morning, when she spoke of how she used to live in hell, alcohol in hell, and how traumatic it was. And, of course, when one's in that condition, the tendency is to think and to look out there as though the problem's out there. And where today, some of the same things had happened that she would have gone to hell over, rather than that she stayed connected to active present love. If you look at the kingdom of heaven, that term can properly be translated from the Aramaic as the community of love. When I seek first the community of love and I am connected, and not only am I connected, but all of those around me are connected, I realize that each piece of work I do with someone, I get to benefit from what I get to process in me. And so as I move forward in my own work, I am able to extend a hand, assist others in moving forward, who then in turn oftentimes will turn around and extend a hand to me in my next piece of work that needs to be done. And so my take from the Aramaic on that would be, when one speaks of a new heaven, it would be that instead of what one thought, you know, you'll remember Yeshua said, if somebody tells you the kingdom of heaven is over there or over there or over there, believe them not, for it is here, it is now, it is within you. So the old heaven was, well, it's off in the sky somewhere, old guy with a beard and white hair, and we're going to play harps. But when one actually does the work of Yeshua, they are connecting to, joining with the community of love, And that arrives in their own mind. Some people might say something like arrives as a cloud in the mind, and that the clouds are being lifted. So moving into that new space of active present love, and then your physiology, which we would call Earth in this circumstance, your carbon-based memory system, you know, we'll back up a little bit. And if we go to the opening words in the book of John, where we're told it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh, what it actually says is, in the beginning was the mind energy, and the mind energy became flesh. So if we come out of a genetic, family, cultural system of rage and guilt and grief and fear, self-blame, blame of others, drama and trauma, then that mind energy, literally, you know, if you take a look at, go to YouTube and just put Bruce Lipton in as a search term and look through some Bruce Lipton videos, or you can look, go to our channel, michaelrice.com, or Michael Rice on YouTube, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-R-Y-C-E on YouTube, and search for why is this happening to me again, and we'll explain exactly how it works. When you think a thought, that thought literally becomes a neuropeptide, a molecule in the body. Something that was quote-unquote not physical previously now becomes what they call physical. Of course, if you listen to Einstein, he says on such things as matter, we've been all wrong. What we have heretofore called matter is energy. Energy whose vibrations have been so lowered as to be perceptible to the senses. There is no matter. There's no such thing as a material world. But when with our faculty of will and imagination, we bring an energy into our field, we introduce an energy that people would call non-physical. We can't sense it with our senses. And then all of a sudden it becomes literally a molecule, called a neuropeptide in the structure. That neuropeptide circulates around in the structure until it finds a cell with a receptor site that matches. That neuropeptide lands on the matching receptor site, and if we were inside the cell watching, what we'd see as that neuropeptide, that molecule, landed on the receptor site, we would literally see energy being inserted into the cell. Now, the cell biologists are saying that the cell replicates it. I do not believe it replicates it any more than my TV replicates the signal at the antenna. Well, it is a replica of the signal at the antenna, but the TV isn't replicating the signal that lands on the antenna. The signal that lands on the antenna inserts itself energetically into the wiring of the TV. The TV decodes it, and it becomes the picture that you see or the sound that you hear. In the same way, that neuropeptide lands on the cell and energetically inserts itself in the cell, and what we would call what's coming into the cell when we see that, we would call that chemistry on the level where we believe in chemistry. Mind energy now is now chemistry. Chemistry alters the cell. The earth has been changed. If I come from a system, a generational system and a culture of rage and fear and hatred and vengeance and alcohol and drug abuse and illness and abandonment and fight and abuse, there's a whole lot of earth that's in a lot of turmoil. This is the person that's going to be sick from day one. I speak from experience. That's where I started out. The last 6 days I was in utero. My mother had toxemia. They gave her Pitocin for 6 days to try to get me out. And the night I was to be born, they called my father at work and said, if you want to see this kid alive, you better get down here because he's not going to live through the night. I was almost dead 4 or 5 times in the first year of my life. The early years in school, I was never in school the first 2 weeks. I was always in an oxygen tent in the hospital. Drugs, they gave me everything. And then as I matured and I had gotten to a study of physics, something just didn't make sense about taking all these toxic substances and trying to get healthy as a result of them. What I realized was they were killing me, and that's when I began to do this work, and that's when I began to do my work. I was the sick kid all the time in my family system. Unfortunately, each of my siblings, who were never sick, have each experienced cancers and other degenerative disorders. And my physiology is healthier now than it has ever been at any point in my life. And I've been around the sun a few times, 2 decades of traveling around the sun. So my take would be that if I look at the Earth suit that I had prior to birth, at birth, the first years of my life, when I lived on an inhalator and pills, drugs, that's how I lived, I had a certain Earth. And my Earth suit has been totally reformed since then. And I wouldn't trade any year of my life before now for my physiology today. My lungs were always a challenge to me, and up until, was it about 2 years ago now, honey, I got COVID, and the number of times I've circled the sun, and the history of my lung disorders, I should have been one of the first ones dead. A wheeze that I had in my lungs from day one as a kid, it was always there through adulthood. There was always this wheeze in the background. The last time I experienced it was either the third or the fourth day that I had COVID, and my lungs healed as I went through COVID. I got a new Earth suit. I got a new set of lungs out of that. I don't believe anybody's ever died of COVID. A virus is nothing but a bit of genetic material. If the genetic material is of a destructive nature and one holds a lot of destructive mind energy with which they are aging and destroying themselves, are dying as a result of it, it might take, you know, if you take on an energy system is designed to live for eternity and you kill it within 100 years, that's pretty fast. Our culture says if you get to live 100 years, you're doing well. Well, my offering is we're designed to be eternal. And if I'm willing to face and forgive everything in me, every inclination, every energetic pattern from every generation, my bloodline that's ever died, anyone who's ever died, when I'm willing to face and process those energies, then I get to move those out of my system, and each cell that contains some form of disintegrative energy that I forgive, that I process out, that cell is a new piece of earth. So a new heaven and a new earth would be my offering. That's what was being talked about. But because the Greeks didn't have a clue and didn't have the eyes to see or the ears to hear, because this culture is based in that thinking, they think, oh, along came this virus. No, there's no such thing as killing a virus. There's no such thing as a virus that's alive. Viruses are not life. They're just data. If the data resonates in me what I'm already killing myself with, then I'm likely going to die from that interaction with that virus. But it's not going to be the virus. It's what I'm already killing myself with that's resonated, intensified, that I'm not willing to deal with. I know that over the couple of years of COVID, there were several people that I processed with, and they were in some of the darkest places in their minds and in their lives that they'd ever been. COVID resonated the darkness they were already carrying and destroying themselves with. When one turns that around and chooses to go to work and forgive, remove from the structure that which is creating the destruction of the structure, then each disintegrative energy forgiven, removed, means a new earth suit, a new literal, on the level where we believe in chemistry, where we, with our senses, we see chemistry. That doesn't make it the end-all and the be-all, but on the level where we see it, when we have new chemistry, then we have a new cell. And when we choose to face, and again, go back to those opening words in John, what do we have to face? What do we need to deal with? It says, in the beginning was the mind energy, and the mind energy became physiology, became flesh. Not in the beginning was the word, mind energy. Yes, and mind energy is reflected by words. That's why Yeshua says the power of life and death is in your words. You want to be aware and conscious of the words you use, because if you use words that represent frequencies that are disintegrative relative to an energy system that's designed to function as and be fully connected to love, then you're in the process of destroying that energy system. If you face everything in the carbon-based memory system of the generations, if you're willing to feel, embrace, hold love present as pain and trauma unresolved from generations, pain and trauma of family losses of a child or losses of a parent or a war or losses of a property or an accident or, you know, the million things that have gone on. You know, you stop and think in the last 75 years, and actually this statistic goes back probably 10 years now, but in the 75 years prior to then, the statistic said at least we had counted that we had killed at least 175 million people on the earth in war. What kind of mind energy does that lead to? What happens to the child being raised up in the midst of a place where a bomb dropped yesterday and a bomb dropped the day before and one's going to drop again tomorrow? What kind of mind energy? Like, what are we doing to ourselves? What is this insanity? And who's willing to literally open up the genes to those energetic patterns that are stored, and they've proven in the lab that those things are stored generation to generation. When I remove those patterned energies that don't belong in my lung, my liver, my heart, or my brain, then my lung, my liver, my heart, or my brain becomes new tissue, a new earth. So that would be my take on that one. I hope that fits for you, makes sense. If you have any thoughts about it, it'd be awesome if you pressed one and we could have a conversation and see if there's anything else that we need to refine in that regard. So if you're out there in listener land, our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number, you'll be calling the show directly. And then if you push 1, through the magic of technology, that's going to raise a hand. Jeannie's going to know you want to talk to us, and she's going to introduce you by your area code. So, Miss Jeannie, do we have anything happening in the chat room, any more emails to look at, or anybody in the phone queue with a hand up?
There is a hand up. And I
awesome. Let's say hello.
Chris, 404, you're on the air.
Michael. Jeannie, hi.
Hey, welcome, young man.
I don't have much to say other than I find it quite amazing that you two have the show, not a show, but a phone Zoom call or whatever it is, 5 days a week, religiously on time, and these redundancies are good for me. And
you got to hear it 1,000 times in 1,000 ways to fit it all together and make a whole picture that the mind can then support moving beyond the past.
Well, that's why I try to get a few listens in a week. But it's just impressive. It's very impressive that for all these years, like 5 days a week, I guess, you're dedicated to this 1 to 2 p.m. telephone call, and me being impressed with that makes me want to listen more, even though I don't, you know, even though I just get little bits and pieces.
If you're not available for the live show, remember we've got over 5,000 hours from the last 14 years of doing this. So at any time you want, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Gee, I can't sleep. Click, go look up a topic on the radio show and listen from the call from back in, you know, 2015 or whatever.
Right. Well, I find it an accomplishment just that I'm listening to this right now, much less going back in the archives. But are the archives categorized as to subject matter?
There is a database you can do a search. Not all of them. Jeannie has kept notes for years on them, but in the early days, we didn't have the facility to make notes. So some of the early shows especially don't have any notes to them, and they're actually some of the most powerful shows. If you do go back to listen, you know, the way to get to them, if you go to our website, wygen.org, and there's a picture of a microphone on the page. If you click that picture, you can drill down. And in particular, there's, and I'm not sure exactly how they're titled, Jeannie can tell us, there's a section of what we consider to be our most important shows, the ones that we're, you know, like seeing this one's like, this is really on track. So there are a number of those. And also in that grouping, there are a number of shows where we've done worksheets with people so that you can listen in on a live worksheet that, you know, I think there right now there's something like 22 or 23 hours of shows where we've been doing worksheets with people. And, you know, when I do a worksheet with someone, this person has this refinement and this question, and that person has a different refinement, a different question, and the next person brings up a different idea. So if you listen to all of those, you'll get a much bigger picture of how the forgiveness process works and how the worksheet is done.
Okay. I do have a now. I do have a Bible question. I thought it up.
Great.
Is there a readily available Bible? I'm going to say that you would approve of for reading. I mean, like, be it the Aramaic. If there's reprints of that manuscript, I mean, like, I can't pick up King James and start reading that. I mean, I'm competent in the English language, but I feel like I'm
right.
It's all Greek to me.
It's all Greek. That's exactly what Yeshua would say. If he sat in most of the church, indeed, he'd say, that's all Greek to me. Because it is.
So what readily available Bible is there that you would recommend, if there is one?
Well, there is a text that was done by a man named George Lamsa. And Lamsa's Bible, it's what it's called, has, unfortunately, very few changes compared to what should have been. Lamsa was doing this back in the 50s. The good fundamental folks of the country literally were threatening to murder him because he wasn't following the King James version of the Bible. I mean, literally, he feared
wow.
for his life and had death threats. So
wow.
George Lamsa was a native Aramaic speaker. And he made approximately 1,600 changes out of what he said should have been at least 10,000. So the work that's available in that text is sparse, and you got to do a lot of reading to get to it. So, I mean, that's a great text. The introduction is good, but, you know, with 1,600 changes through that whole book, it's hard to really make sense of it or make it usable. However, George Lamsa does have several books, and his protege, Rocco Errico, who, by the way, is in Atlanta, and I think is speaking at the, let's see, what's the name of the center?
Well, I'm in
Barbara
Atlanta.
King's. Yes, that's why I'm saying George, or Rocco Errico. And Barbara
Hello?
King's
yes.
Hillside Chapel. If you check them out, you can go hang out with Rocco. He was my first teacher in the Aramaic. He introduced me to the Aramaic language. And he and I
Barbara
used to work together.
King.
I used to Barbara King's
Barbara
Church,
King.
Which is called Hillside Church. Chapel down on the south side of Atlanta.
Okay.
And Rocco is the Aramaic professor there. And
okay.
He has a website.
Well,
he has a website, Nura. Noohra.com. He's got a lot of Aramaic stuff on there. But he has rewritten some of Lamsa's commentaries. So it would be more useful to you to read the commentaries than it would be to get the Lamsa Bible, would be my offering. Because,
but I could also,
again, it's
I could also find out about their church service as well.
Yes, yes. And Lamsa's got a text called Gospel Light, More Light on the Gospel, Old Testament Light, Idioms of the Bibles Explained, the Lord's Prayer. I mean, he's got a whole raft of things, and Rocco has rewritten some of those, so that's all available. And if you check with Noohra, Noohra.com, you'll see, Rocco has all that stuff listed. We also, the text that we're working with from the Aramaic, and it's the only place I know this particular work with the Kabor manuscript, where you'll find the deep psychological insight into the teachings of Yeshua. In many cases where someone has translated from the Aramaic, they actually took a Greek text and then translated it from the Aramaic, or pardon me, translated back into Aramaic, but they still had that Greek influence. And so what we're working with, and basically the text we're working with is called Enlightenment, and it's what we've published so far from the Kabor's manuscript. And it's a text that, if you go to our website on our catalog, it sells for $25 plus shipping. If you want to get a copy and you just go to the website rather than paying shipping and all that, and it adds it automatically, we can't change that. But if you want to get a copy of it, if you go to whyagain.org, down at the bottom there's a donate button. And if you just donate $26, it goes through PayPal, they get something like a buck and a half, so it takes care of them. We'll pay the shipping. So if you want a copy of this text.
What's the name of it? What's the name of it?
It's Enlightenment. Enlightenment.
Okay.
So if you just give us your address and Enlightenment, then we'll know that $26 is for Enlightenment, and we'll get one out right away to you.
Yes, okay. Gosh, were the Greeks good for anything?
Oh, well, I think they gave us a lot of good stuff, and, there's an interesting passage in the scriptures where Yeshua talks about those who are the highest in a certain realm are the lowest in what, again, was translated as the kingdom of heaven. And what they were saying is, carbon-based memory, the body's mind can only go so far because it's an inferior device. It can't reflect the actuality of life. So when Yeshua talked about that, he said, so you got these people that are brilliant, they're geniuses, they have wonderful minds, and the very highest of those, like in the realm of man, they're at level 100 on the 100, the 100-step ladder. But the minute they step over that, they're on step one in the community of love. Because carbon-based memory.
Are you talking about Greek culture? I mean, I don't know that much about it. I remember in, grade school, learning a little bit about Greek mythology. But, I mean, does the Greek culture and have anything positive to contribute? It sounds almost like not.
Well, it's relative, in terms of the way human minds think, that is some pretty incredible stuff. Some pretty amazing stuff. But when you go to the way the human being functions, all of that is inferior. So again, they're the pinnacle of human culture, at least one of the Chinese as well. They did just some amazing stuff. But the pinnacle of human culture, when you think of human being, this body-mind unit and the ability of the mind to perceive, to create constructs called perception, which is what you want to be collapsing with forgiveness, they're the pinnacle. But then when you go to living in the actuality, there's some Harvard research that we've talked about that says that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells are firing. They got somebody hooked up to electrodes, and they measure that there are 10,000 brain cells firing off. What they tell us is, and this is some of the most quoted research in all of history, of psychological history, it goes back, and that in that time frame where 10,000 brain cells firing, the max amount of data that goes into building perception is 9 bits. So we've got this 10,000 brain cells firing, and the mind filters it down to 9 pieces of data. It's been estimated in the same time frame that the actuality of the world is perhaps 20 trillion bits of data. So if that's accurate, and we're living in an actual 20 trillion bit world with a 9-bit mind that's only able to comprehend from 10,000 bits of information, it's a pretty inferior device. my take is that in our being, in the truth of who we are, that newborn, when you hold them, that newborn is designed to be capable of functioning within the 20 trillion bit world. And we've been shut down to a 9-bit mind that is the inheritor of the hostilities, the fears, the rages, the guilt, the grief, the pain, the drama and trauma of the world.
But what if that 20,000, 20 trillion bit baby, what if that baby has the best of parents and on the planet, and there's no abuse, no any, you know, that baby's
then,
raised.
Then we're
going to
say what we've got is we've got a true human being happening here. They're few and far between. It does happen.
You mean there are parents like that on this earth that can keep the baby's 20 trillion bits cognizance?
Well, I haven't met anybody that's fully arrived, but I know a lot of people who are progressing in that direction. I look at, you know, I was doing this work back when I had my children, and they're now in their 40s, and with what I know now, there are so many things I lament having done that I sure as heck would have done very, very differently than today. And today I have
about,
this awesome little teacher.
What about self-love?
Let me just finish the thought off here so I can complete that thought. So I now have this teacher that's 5 who's came into the earth, into the world, very clearly to me as the active presence of love, as did my daughter. When my daughter was born, I caught her in my hands, and she opened her eyes and looked at me and literally sent me into that 20 trillion bit world. I now realize that's what happened. It was just monumental. But I still hadn't done enough work to be as clean and clear with her as I'm able to be now with our granddaughter, who's 5, who's teaching me how to function as love and how to see her only as love, and to assist her in building her energy field, her body-mind unit, to be a fit vehicle to express who her created essence is. To me, that's what parenthood is about, that each of us were designed to give to our children. But the world hasn't done a very good job of teaching us that.
That's amazing. I imagine I'm going to guess that corporal punishment of children, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child, doesn't figure into the scenario of proper child.
Not in a million years.
Well,
the child.
What?
Yeah, unfortunately, my offering is.
We've all done it. You know, that she's 4 years old, and you slap her or him.
Unfortunately, I haven't done that, but.
Well, I mean.
The voice, the look.
You know, I mean, I have. I mean, it was like twice in my 2 daughters' lives, you know. I mean, nothing, you know, nothing that would be considered abnormal parenting. They may have been 6 or 7 or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's not good. It's not good, you're saying.
No. No, what I'm offering, you know, if you think about how tender, one of the things I'll often hear from people when I talk, you know, when I have a conversation like this, and somebody will say, well, you know, my parents slapped me around a good bout, but it never hurt me. It's like, excuse me, friend, if I were able to take you back to the moment where that parent not even slapped you, not even said something, but when that parent turned to you with hostility in their eyes, if I could take you back to that moment, into that tender space, you would experience some of the most extreme pain that any human being has ever experienced.
Because, oh, well, I remember.
I remember
every time I got spanked. My parents didn't slap me around. They were not what people would consider to be abusive. But it was, you know, sometime around 10 or 12 years old, my mother used a hairbrush, and my dad used his hand, and it was ritualistic, but I remember every second of every time.
Yeah, yeah. But if you were to go back to the you know, a song that comes to mind that to me explains this very well. If you remember the song, the line in this song about Vincent Van Gogh that said, "This world was never meant for one as beautiful as you."
Yes, incredible.
That
song.
That tender state of being is where we all started. And if any one of us were able to go back to that moment, when just a hostile set of eyes were turned toward us, the pain of that would be so extreme that it's unimaginable. And ultimately, to go back and undo the history of that in our whole bloodline is the objective of this work. It's not, wow, oh, yeah, we're going to go do a weekend workshop and heal. It's taking on a lifetime of work of cleaning up those generational patterns of coming out of the desert. You know, you look at that story of the Jews wandering in the desert, and people think it was about being in a hot, sandy place, a 35-square-mile area. Do you think this group of people who understands astronomy quite well could possibly get lost in a 35-square-mile area for 40 years? I mean, that's just silly on its face. But when you realize that was a metaphor for people living unconsciously and the desert being unconscious and creating their lives out of those unconscious generational patterns, and then you look in that passage, in that story, how did they get out of the desert into what was called the Promised Land, and what was the Promised Land? Well, if you read it, what it says is the way they got out of the desert, they said the old generation had to die off. That didn't mean everybody in old physical bodies had to physically die. The root of the word generation is genari. It means cause. All of the causes held in the mind, held in the genes from the generations had to be removed. And then we stepped out of creating our lives out of unconscious energy into what was called the Promised Land. And that wasn't a land of milk and honey and palm trees. That was a land of conscious co-creation where we knew who we were as love. We knew we were creators, and we originated mind energy and created our lives anew. That's what was being spoken about there.
And then my dad.
And that's what this work is about.
My dad would say, "Well, Chris, this is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. You know, it's
hurt
about
you. Yeah, right.
This is going to hurt me. Well, no, I feel like I had good parents. This is going to hurt
me. I'm not suggesting you did.
This is going to hurt me more than it's going to have you," as he put me over his knee. And,
yep.
But still, that's not constructive child rearing, I guess.
Well, you know, another one that I remember that you probably remember too is, if you don't stop that crying, I'll give you something to cry for. It's like, wait a minute, I have
that.
Something to cry for. That's why I'm crying. What are you talking about? But, you know, those patterns and it's all what needs to be forgiven. It's all what needs, literally on an energetic level, has become literal physiological chemistry, mind energy becoming flesh, and needs to be extracted from the cell, exposed to the presence of love, and removed from the structure. That's what forgiveness is to remove every energy of offense in any way, shape, or form. And what I realize, what my granddaughter has taught me, is that my job as her grandfather is to identify her only as love. And if she does something that resonates anything other than love in me, to recognize that's my work to do, and for me to do my work as quickly as possible so that I can return to this space where, as love, I identify her as love, and I give her guidance and education on how to build a body-mind unit that is of being an expression of and a vehicle for her full manifestation, or her full purpose being fulfilled in the world. That's my job as her parent or grandparent.
All right, Michael, I have another question for you.
Go for it.
With this work, you know, where you print out these exercises, is there like plateau stages that one reaches where
yes.
one
– very common.
My question, where one feels better or is it just like – it's probably – my guess is it's an infinite amount of work.
It is.
But are there – it is. Okay. But there are goals and or not goals. You don't like that term. But there are plateau stages if you've done enough of this work where you feel better.
There are plateau stages where you're gonna feel better, number one. There are plateau stages where it feels like you're not getting anywhere And other times when it's like the major breakthrough is just like huge. And actually, one of my favorite words is goals, and it's one of the most important thing you can do in your life is set goals. Without goals, you and I would be dead. It's not the goal that's the problem. It's when we formulate goals out of hostility and fear that engage disintegrative energy within us that it becomes a problem. And the reason you cancel a goal is not because there's anything wrong with the goal. You only cancel the goal because you recognize that it's resonating some form of hostility or fear in you that needs to be cleaned up, that needs to be removed. But the goals, I mean, we've got a workshop called Getting the Stress You Need. The worksheet in that workshop is the Mind Goal Management Sheet. It's here's how you manage your goals to manage your mind so that you're a conscious creator in your life. So goals are a wonderful thing. It's just if they're mismanaged, we're in trouble.
Yes.
Breathing with you. I'm glad to be talking with you right now, hearing your voice.
Hi, Michael.
Sounds like you've been seriously doing some work.
That depends on how you define work.
Well, you wouldn't be able to ask me the questions you're asking if you hadn't done the work, because you wouldn't have the brain cells to do it. So I can tell, you know, from earlier conversations that we've had, how much work you've done by simply the capacity you have to ask questions. If you hadn't done any, you wouldn't even, those questions would never come to you, the questions, most of them that you've been asking. So I acknowledge you for the work you've been doing.
Most of what I get from you is listening to your 1 to 2 p.m. Discussion. I mean, just put it that way.
That's what we're here to do. So breathing with you. And actually, I have a private thought I'd like to share with you, and we're finished the show in 5 minutes. So when we complete the show, I know that you don't usually answer calls or you're blocked, but when we get off the show, I'll give you a call. I have a thought for you.
Okay.
So you've got about 5 minutes. Any other questions or thoughts?
Not at this moment.
So you're just going to leave me hanging for the last 5 minutes without another question. Okay. That's the way you're going to do it. Delighted, sir. Delighted.
Well, you know, at least, not at least. I was looking positive. Barbara King's Hillside Chapel. There might be some people in my area, and we would go there, whether it's a Sunday or a Saturday or a Monday. I intend to go there, so putting that out means that, you know, there's some people in the Atlanta area that might be improved by going to Barbara King's Hillside Chapel, which I have no idea where it's located. But
it's down on the southwest side of town. She's been, well, I first met Barbara probably 43, 44 years ago when she came to one of my workshops in Florida. But she had the Hillside Chapel back then, and they've done a lot of great work over the years. So,
well, that's
you're
good.
There
that's
locally.
Good. I'm glad for that.
And if you get to connect with Rocco directly, please tell him I said hello and hug his neck for me. Tell him
Rocco.
I send my love and highest regards, Rocco Errico. He's their resident Aramaic scholar.
Rocco sounds like the name of an Italian.
Yeah, he is. He's Italian. He's Italian. That's Rocco.
But
he worked
hitman
with George Lamsa. He was George Lamsa's protege back when Lamsa was translating, and they worked together for years. So
George Lamsa.
All right, well, we're down to the last minute here, so I'm just going to say thank you for the conversation, and everybody, thanks for joining us. Have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world, and blessings.